You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
So the title of this panel is U.S.-Taiwan Mainland China Relations Within New Political Environments, and we sooner or later have to come back to this triangle, but we are in a situation with political transitions going on. Taiwan was inaugurated on May 20th. The United States finally will have an election on November 8th, and Xi Jinping in 2017 will be sort of campaigning for reselection. And so it's an environment that has more than average interest. So to help us explore this, we have four great scholars. First is Tsai Ming-yen, who is professor of the Graduate Institute of International Politics at National Zhongxing University. My good friend, Bonnie Glazer, who's a senior advisor for Asia and the director of a really new and exciting project at CSIS, the China Power Project. And then Professor Zhao Sui-sung, who is professor of the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the director of the Center for China-U.S. Cooperation, which is doing great work. And he is also the editor of the Journal of Contemporary China, which is making a major contribution to sort of the dissemination of knowledge about China. So without further ado, Professor Tsai. Oh, I'm sorry. I missed Professor Lin altogether. I'm really sorry. I was on the wrong page. So another friend, Lin Wancheng, who is Professor of College of Social Science at National Sun Yat-sen University.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bush. Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I'm very delighted to have this opportunity to, you know, come to attend this symposium to share my view with you. So I would like to thank the Dr. Dean for inviting me. Of course, I must say, you know, to make a presentation in the afternoon of Washington, D.C. is the most difficult time for me because, you know, Washington, D.C. time and Taipei time are just, you know, completely upside. I'm, you know, asked by the conference organizers, you know, to make a presentation on the triangular relationship among the United States, China, and Taiwan. So I will focus on the two bilateral relationship, you know, Taiwan cross-trade relation, and United States relations with China. My colleague, Dr. Tsai, will focus on U.S.-Taiwan relationship. Well, you know, Taiwan is a small third party in the relationship between the United States and China. United States is very big, is the very big third party in cross-trade relations. Well, I think that, of course, you know, Scott's presentation made my presentation easier. I believe that cross-trade exchange, especially economic relationship, is quite asymmetrical, you know. So it is quite easy, you know, manipulated by Beijing against Taiwan. Here, of course, Scott already give you some data. In terms of investments, in terms of trade, or in terms of tourism, you know, the exchanges are quite, you know, asymmetrical. So Scott already give you, you know, the figures. Our export to China and Hong Kong accounted for 39.4% of our total trade. And our investment in mainland China, don't trust our government's official figure because it's underestimated, you know. It is believed that Taiwan's investment in mainland China is more than, you know, $200 billion. Of course, the official figure is just slightly more than, you know, $157 billion. And in terms of tourism, you know, the tourist industry is Taiwanese tourists made, you know, 5.5 million trips to China in 2015. So, and the Chinese tourists only made 3.3 million trips to Taiwan in 2015. So, so our tourists actually contribute, you know, more to China's economy than, you know, the Chinese tourists to our economy. But the problem is that we are a democratic society. We cannot control our tourists to where they can go. And China as an authoritarian regime, so under the authoritarian regimes, it's quite easy for them to manipulate, to control the Chinese tourists not coming to Taiwan. Those are just, you know, the data for you, you know, to understand the kind of asymmetrical economical relationship between the two sides. Because of time limits, so I will be very, you know, quick, you know, to go over, you know. In terms of investment, China's investment in Taiwan is less than $1.5 billion compared with Taiwan's investment in mainland China. It is nothing. And tourists, as I just mentioned, you know, we made more trip to mainland China. Of course, I myself contribute more than 10 times every year. Okay, trade, you know. So, but I believe that China must be very frustrated because the so-called economic integration does not promote cross-trade political integration. You know, this, you know, is, you know, the survey to indicate Taiwanese people's attitude toward unification or independence. In the 8 years under President Ma's leadership, cross-trade relationship was quite good. But, you know, China also, you know, gave a lot of economic favor to Taiwan. But such a, you know, good relationship, you know, and China's, you know, friendly policy did not change Taiwanese people's, you know, attitude toward unification or independence. You can see that the trend in terms of, you know, cross-trade unification, the trend in Taiwan is moving toward Taiwan independence. So I can understand China's frustration. And so perceptions of Beijing's hostility in Taiwan, no big change. And so in the future, you know, social economic integration, the situation is that there is a social economic integration without political integration between the two sides of the Taiwan's trade. Okay, now we come to, you know, China's era, you know, beginning from May 20, well, only 5 minutes left. Okay, I think I will skip this part because, you know, so much has been, you know, talked in the first panels and Deputy Minister Lin's, you know, keynote speech also talk about cross-trade relations, and they introduce, they talk about, you know, President Tsai's policy toward mainland China. So I think I will mainly skip this part. Okay, Scott also mentioned about, you know, President Tsai's, you know, New South Bond policy, because before, you know, President Tsai took office, we predicted that China might use economic means to punish Taiwan, to put pressure on Taiwan. Of course, you know, the New South Bond policy does not really target China. President Tsai already proposed cooperation with China in Southeast Asia or, you know, South Asia. But we need to find a way out for our businessmen when China's economy slows down. Okay, Beijing's responded to President Tsai's inaugural address, I think it's well known. They are not satisfied. And the United States government's response is quite positive. And United States responded to, you know, President Tsai's New South Bond policy is quite supportive. Of course, China continue to say no. But how to interpret, you know, Beijing's response to President Tsai's, you know, government? I think, you know, there are three possible ways to interpret Beijing's response. The first one is that it might be just a Beijing strategy to push, you know, Tsai Ing-wen further. Beijing continues to say no, and to see how, you know, China would respond, you know, or whether China would make further concessions. The second possibility is that Xi Jinping, who is preoccupied with the restructuring of the power in the party, faces a series of domestic challenges and cannot show flexibility on cross-trade relations for the time being, or at least before the 19th Party Congress. And the third possibility, I think that's the worst, you know, scenario, that the, an arrogant China, which believes that it has an up hand against Taiwan, so we will, you know, continue to increase the pressure on the Tsai, you know, government, here President Tsai, do you accept the so-called 92 consensus? And my understanding is that President Tsai cannot accept the 92 consensus, at least in the near future. So you can see that there is a deadlock, the stagnation in cross-trade relations. According, okay, then I will jump to this one, you know, the Beijing's strategies toward Taiwan, to be a part of China, then you will have all the benefits. Your economy will be very prosperous. And if you are away from Taiwan, then you will be dead, you know. So it broke, you know, the three doors for Taiwan to be connected with the outside world. And keep one door open, that door is open to China. Okay, then let's come to talk about, you know, the relationship between the two giants. Are they sincere? They talk a lot of words. Many times they emphasize the word in cooperation. You know, Beijing say cooperation, United say, you know, emphasize the importance of cooperation with each other. Are they sincere? But according to Wang Jishi and Kenneth Liebesel, they were serious, you know, mutual distrust between the two countries, and it became worse, you know. Okay, of course, you know, there are areas or issues which encourage, you know, the two countries to cooperate with each other. But there are a lot of issues that they have conflict of national interest. But according to some, you know, Chinese scholar, or you know, Dr. Bush also mentioned in his books that there is the all the problem in this bilateral relationship come from the so-called structural conflict. United States as an existing dominant power would like to maintain the position as the only superpower. And the rising power, you know, China as a rising power, which is not satisfied with such a power relationship, you know, would like to challenge the United States. Okay, so to some scholars, you know, a situation of power transition is occurring between the two countries. Then, who is the boss? According to, you know, a survey, you know, conducted, you know, to people in the 11 countries in Asia, who is the boss in Asia? You know, in 2010, still 65, six countries believe the United States was the boss in 2010, and five countries which believe that China was the boss in the regions. But 10 years from, you know, 2010, in 2020, only two countries left which believe that United States is still the boss in the regions, you know. And then, of course, I list, you know, a lot of, you know, policy adopted by, you know, Beijing, you know, to deal with the United States, okay. Well, the time control asked me to stop. So I think one more minute, you know. Factors affecting the future, you know, relationship between the two countries. Who will be U.S. New president? And Xi Jinping as China's decision maker till 2022 at least. After he consolidated his power, will he become more flexible, or he will continue to be so assertive? You know, implication for Taiwan. Taiwan's option. To take, you know, the Chinese side, some American scholars suggest that the United States should encourage Taiwan to accept the Finland model. Really, I don't understand why, you know. And a model of commonwealths and confederations to accept China's one country, two systems model. is unlikely, is no longer attractive. This morning, we talk about Hong Kong. Hong Kong's case, what happened in Hong Kong, you know, announced the death of, you know, one country, two cities model for the people in Taiwan, and permanent neutrality to take an American side to maintain status quo, you know, to take the, you know, Chinese side, you know, at least we accept the one country, two cities model. And it's unlikely for the people in Taiwan. And other models, including Finland model, are not supported by China. So we will continue our traditional approach to take an American side. But the one question in our mind is whether we can trust the United States or not. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good afternoon, everyone here. In this panel, we are assigned to talk about the U.S.-China-Taiwan relations. Okay. And my colleague, Professor Lin Wen-Chen, has covered U.S.-China relations a lot. So I'm going to focus my presentation on U.S.-Taiwan relations and the Coast Strait relations. In terms of U.S.-Taiwan relations, I basically take a very optimistic attitude. The reason why I say so is because our countries share common concerns, that is to maintain the status quo and the stability across the Taiwan Strait and around the region. We all want a stable and a predictable relations with China. However, the cooperation with Beijing is not supposed to sacrifice our own security and economic interest. So based on this policy thinking, I think what both U.S. and Taiwan can do next is to have more context so as to coordinate our policy actions and to, you know, to prevent making any kind of surprise to each other. That's the number one thing we can do. And the number two thing maybe our countries can do is to figure out some pillars, key pillars, and the long-term programs to support the economic and the security partnership between our countries. And the first pillar I would like to emphasize would be about the TPP. We know United States is now having policy debates over TPP issues. We totally understand and respect such a debate during presidential campaign. However, I still want to use this chance to share some perspective from Taiwan on this matter. Basically, we think TPP is not only an economic or trade issue, but also a strategic and security issue. What Taiwan wants from TPP is to you know, use TPP as a very strong impetus for Taiwan to carry out upgrading for domestic enterprise. And also, we hope TPP can offer a very good approach for Taiwan to become part of international free trade system, which is proposed and established by our friend United States. So Taiwan has shown very strong interest in joining the second round of TPP negotiation. Even so, Taiwan knows very well it would be a very, very long process to persuade domestic society into accepting such high standard FTA issued by the TPP, just like what's going on in United States right now. So maybe in coming years, both US and Taiwan can cooperate with each other to figure out ways to benefit from our cooperation on TPP issues, to promote our cooperation on FTA. What Taiwan expects from such a cooperation is to promote Taiwan's economic development through trade diversification and to consolidate the economic partnership between our countries. So that is the first pillar I would like to emphasize. And the second pillar I would like to point out would be about defense cooperation between our countries. United States has been the major source for Taiwan to get access to advanced military hardware and software. So in the future, we should continue our cooperation on this matter. Compared to China, Taiwan is much smaller in terms of military size. So we need to figure out a kind of smart strategy to push forward Taiwan's defense modernization. So far, Taiwan has highlighted some priorities. Number one, we want to promote the joint among different military services. And the number two, we would like to facilitate the integrations between our military hardware and software. And number three, we would like to push forward the connections between our civilian society and the military forces. Of course, all these things would require U.S. expertise and assistance. So maybe in the year ahead, we can have some cooperations on this matter to make Taiwan's military forces become a small but mobile and flexible force in the future. Now I'm going to share one of Taiwan's concerns over U.S. arms sales to Taiwan. As I mentioned, the United States has been the major force for Taiwan to get advanced weapon system. However, a concern in Taiwan is about the China factor. Some people in Taiwan is afraid that the Beijing factor is becoming more and more influential in the process of U.S. decision to sell weapons to Taiwan. We know Washington made very clear that it won't consult with Beijing before selling weapons to Taiwan. However, it's true that Washington needs to take into account Beijing factor. So there is a proposal in Taiwan which argues that Taiwan may be able to consider the possibility to produce weapon system on our own, particularly for those sensitive weapon system that United States may be not able to offer to Taiwan. Submarine and the jet fighters would be the cases. Of course, we know it's not that easy for Taiwan to produce such advanced weapon system on our own without any help from the United States. We know if it will. So maybe in the coming years, both U.S. and Taiwan can work together to evaluate the potential or possibility for Taiwan to produce a weapon system on our own. And Taiwan's expectation from such a proposal is that maybe we can promote our cooperation between defense industry. This may be a good way for Taiwan to beef up its defense capability and to consolidate the security partnership between United States and Taiwan without hurting Washington's relations with Beijing that much. So that is the second pillar I want to share with our friends here. And now I'm going to spend a couple of minutes on Cold Strait relations. Basically, I think the current relationship between two sides of trade is not like good and not like bad. In Taiwan, we use the term cold peace to describe the current situation. And the reason why Cold Strait relations becoming so, I mean cold peace, is not because new president come out. It's because new general public's opinion turned out after the presidential election of this January. 92 consensus was a very important proposal for KMT and Beijing to work together to handle cross-strait relations in the last 8 years. However, Taiwan's general public doesn't like this idea that much anymore. So as a newly elected president, Tsai Ing-wen has to figure out something, create something new to serve as a kind of common ground inside Taiwan society and between two sides of the strait. This is the reason why Tsai Ing-wen proposed that Taiwan may be able to use ROC constitution system to handle Taiwan's relations with China. ROC constitutional system contains one China spirit somehow on one hand. On the other, it also reflects the political reality that Taiwan has been outside PRC's control ever since 1949. So this is a very new try, to narrow down the political gap between Beijing's insistence on 92 consensus and the Taiwan general public's expectation for greater political autonomy. So this is a very, to me, a kind of creative try. So I think any kind of move to stabilize Cold Strait relations should be encouraged. To stick to ROC constitution system is a very big move made by the DPP. So maybe in the future, in the month ahead, United States can play a kind of active or constructive role to encourage both sides of the strait particularly Beijing, to resume official contact with Taiwan. If we don't have official contacts, maybe we have to maintain some other dialogue mechanism live, like track 1.5 or track 2 dialogue mechanism, so as to avoid any kind of misunderstandings or misperceptions across the Taiwan Strait. Also, to prevent the current Coast Strait court peace from becoming a kind of court foundation in the future. So that's my presentation on U.S.-China-Taiwan relations to share with our friends here. Let me stop here. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Tsai. Bonnie?
Thank you, Richard. I'm going to limit my remarks to U.S. policy toward Taiwan. I'm going to start by looking back. It was suggested to me to talk about U.S. policy during the transition. I'll touch a little bit also on the campaign period, because I think we can draw some lessons about U.S. policy toward Taiwan going forward from U.S. policy as it was conducted during the transition. And then I will very briefly look forward and identify some of the factors that will influence U.S. policy going forward. So I'm going to identify basically six themes about U.S. policy toward the transition. The first is that the U.S. remained even-handed and respected Taiwan's democratic process. So, of course, the United States hosted both of the main candidates, Tsai Ing-wen, Eric Chu, both came to Washington. In contrast to 2012, there was no either public or on background criticism of any candidate. And interestingly, when Ma Ying-jeou went to Singapore and met with Xi Jinping, in the questions afterwards that were posed to Assistant Secretary of State Danny Russell about whether this meeting would somehow help either the KMT or the DPP, he stated the U.S. Does not pick sides in the race, but rather has a strong stake in Taiwan's democracy, economy, security, and stability in the Taiwan Strait. Second point. The Obama administration has focused on the need to preserve cross-strait peace and stability. This really has been, I think, the core of U.S. policy during the campaign and the transition. The reemergence clearly of cross-strait tensions would pose a serious risk to American security and interests. If it is a military confrontation, it is one in which the U.S. could be drawn into. And even if diplomatic tensions rise, then the danger exists that the Taiwan issue becomes more prominent once again in the U.S.-China relationship, crowding out other issues, dominating the agenda, and making it difficult to address other things in the relationship at a time where we have a much more competitive relationship with China and a lot of issues that need to be dealt with, and, of course, a leader that has a style of decision-making that involves very few people, and so that meeting bilaterally between the two presidents has become even more important than it was in the past. So even 8 months before the election, when Susan Thornton gave a speech here at Brookings, she emphasized that the critical component of U.S.-Taiwan relations was stable management of cross-strait ties. And a particular element of this that the U.S. has been concerned about during the campaign, the tradition, and today is the nature of the channels between the DPP and China. So these channels of communication, are they reliable? Can information be exchanged reliably, or is there a potential for miscalculation? Is there a need for the U.S. to play a more active role and maybe even a mediating role? And so, of course, if we go back to the Chen Shui-bian era, there was a more active U.S. Policy during the transition and involvement between the two sides of the strait. We did not see, and my third point would be, that the U.S. did not get directly involved in any mediation and really had a more passive, played a more passive role than it did in 2000. I think this was partly because China was not putting an enormous amount of pressure on Taiwan. there were really overt threats. There was little coercion. Lots of calm statements about the consequences that would follow if Tsai Ing-wen didn't accept the 1992 consensus. But that was primarily the gist and focus of China's policy. And Beijing really didn't put a lot of pressure on the United States to urge Tsai Ing-wen to accommodate. So my analysis is that Xi Jinping has greater confidence in his ability to deal with Taiwan. He has a bigger toolbox with which to manage Taiwan, and really did not want or see the need for a lot of U.S. Involvement, and simply, I think, laid down markers in his meeting with President Obama about not playing a negative role. The U.S., I think, also another reason why the U.S. didn't get involved in more active mediation is that the United States had a degree of confidence that there were some reliable communication channels between the DPP and the PRC. And, of course, as Tsai Ing-wen became inaugurated, she has spoken more publicly now about these channels. You may have seen her interview, for example, that she gave to the Washington Post. Fourth factor, the U.S. urged both Beijing and Taipei to be flexible in the interest of maintaining peace and stability. So U.S. officials hoped that neither Tsai Ing-wen nor Beijing would be too rigid, that both sides would do their utmost to try and find some new formulation that would maintain that stability in the cross-strait relationship. And on occasion, we heard U.S. officials say some things publicly. After the September 2015 summit between Xi Jinping and President Obama, a U.S. senior U.S. official told the media that U.S. fundamental interests are in cross-strait stability and that the United States would continue to counsel restraint on the part of Beijing, so privately and publicly. Fifth theme, throughout the campaign and since the election, the U.S. remained clear and consistent that its policy is based on the three U.S.-China communiques, the Taiwan Relations Act, and on one occasion, a U.S. official even referred to the six assurances. So the United States did not get drawn into the dispute over the 1992 consensus and over one China principle, and simply maintained its own position and policies. I think these are all important going forward. And the sixth and final theme is that the United States, during the whole period of the campaign and the transition, sustained cooperation in the U.S.-China in the U.S.-Taiwan relationship and continued to promote it and try to strengthen the bilateral relationship. So one example is the conference that took place at George Washington University, halfway pretty much between the election and the inauguration, which was on the global cooperation and training framework between the U.S. and Taiwan. And we saw there Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary Kurt Tung deliver a speech on the record in which he emphasized the need to expand Taiwan's role in the international community, the commitment of the U.S. to exploring new ways for Taiwan to earn dignity and respect, and that its contributions that are consistent with its contributions to global efforts. So I give the Obama administration high marks for clearly conveying its concerns, its priorities to both sides of the strait, while respecting Taiwan's democratic processes, reiterating its consistent support and commitments to Taiwan, and trying to create an environment in which Beijing and Taipei can manage their differences. So very briefly, looking forward at factors that will influence U.S. strategy and policy toward cross-strait relations going forward, certainly I think the United States will continue to call for flexibility, for creativity, and restraint on both sides. There will be continued emphasis on trying to preserve, I think, Taiwan's autonomy and prosperity. So I'm going to identify three factors going forward. One is, as I said earlier, the efficacy of cross-strait communication channels. The U.S. believes that if there is an absence of dialogue, if communication channels are unreliable, then there is a heightened risk of misunderstanding, potentially miscalculation. The U.S. could urge both sides more strongly to open up a dialogue channel that would be more official, if there or something that at least would be reliable, if it has these concerns, and could begin to play a more active mediating role if it loses confidence in the ability of the two sides of the strait to be able to communicate effectively with each other. The second factor, I think, going forward is Taiwan's policies and the extent to which these policies are viewed as a potential cause of cross-strait instability. This is not something that we have seen so far, but of course it's something that we have to at least hold open the possibility that it might occur going forward. So these are issues like military deployments and strategy. Will they be defensive or will they be seen as provocative? Or, for example, and this is just a hypothetical, an attempt to use the name Taiwan to join the UN. Once again, we've heard Foreign Minister Li rule that out, or maybe even participate in the Olympics under the name Taiwan, which there are, of course, some people in Taiwan who want to do both of these things in the UN and the Olympics to have a different name. So finally, the last factor is the degree and nature of PRC pressure on Taiwan. And here, I think this is the most important factor. Will we see economic pressure grow? We've seen mainland tourists obviously been reduced to Taiwan. The revenues for the tourist industry in Taiwan are declining. Will we see greater economic pressure? Are we going to see greater diplomatic pressure? We have the International Civil Aviation meeting coming up. September 27th, uncertain whether or not China is going to allow or will block Taiwan from sending a delegation, which it sent 3 years ago. So the United States, if its concerns grow in this area, could possibly do the following. Public and statements of expressions of concern, private statements to the PRC, saying, for example, that such actions are likely to be counterproductive, cause greater hostility in Taiwan toward the mainland, cause greater friction even in U.S.-China relations. And there could be possible efforts by the United States to offset that pressure. So to help Taiwan's economy, maybe talk with Taiwan about FTA, urge other countries to do the same, seek ways to increase Taiwan's participation in international activities, maybe bolster this global training and cooperation framework further, and work more actively with Taiwan to increase its voice in the international community in other ways. Finally, I would say if there is military pressure, and I talked so far about economic and diplomatic, that I think that would likely provoke warnings and potentially a U.S. military response. Of course, we could not rule that out depending on the nature of military pressure. So I think I'll stop there. My time is running out. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. Before I turn to Sam, if I could just supplement in two ways. I agree fully with just every dot and comma of your presentation. But 2 points. First of all, I think that this transition was easier than 2000 because everybody knew long before the election who was going to win. And the first sign in 2000 that we took seriously that Chen Shui-bian was going to win came privately 2 to 3 weeks before the actual election. Fortunately, we had made preparations for that eventuality. But I think that when you know what the outcome of the election is going to be, the possibilities of panic on all sides is less. Second, going forward, I think that what the United States will do will be very much a function of the level of knowledge and understanding and judgment of the officials who will be in charge of U.S. policy. And I'll make what may be perceived as a partisan statement here. I have much more confidence in one camp than I do in another. Sam.
Okay, thank you, Richard and Scott and Zhengzhou University for putting together this conference and inviting me back. last year when this conference, my presentation, I mentioned 3 points to the three players. To the U.S., I said, stay on course. For Taiwan, no surprise. For China, be patient. So looking back, I would say that the U.S. has stayed on course really well so far, as both Richard and Bonnie mentioned. The Obama administration has responded to this power transition in Taiwan as gracefully as good as the U.S. could do. On the Taiwan side, I have not seen any surprise yet. Tsai Ing-wen has promised to maintain status quo and acknowledge the Constitution of the Republic of China. However, he will not say the Beijing's words of the 1992 consensus, which I think is anticipated. The DPP administration could not be same as the KMT, otherwise people will not elect the DPP into the office. So on the Taiwan side, I will say there's no surprise yet. Now, on the China side, be patient. That is an issue I think we worry a lot. From my perspective, I'm a little bit pessimistic. So far, not many actions as they threatened before the inauguration, but still not concerns. Let me go back a little bit to the China's reactions to the election of the President Tsai. China was, of course, everybody said, everybody anticipated her election, but what Beijing was very, very suspicious of her, never trusted the DPP, not Chen Shui-bian, not even Tsai Ing-wen, although these two people could be different. When she promised to maintain status quo, for Beijing, what they saw when Ma Ying-jeou said status quo have 3 points, no independence, no unification, no war. That's status quo. For Beijing, the status quo is more like no independence. But for them to see Tsai Ing-wen's status quo is no unification. So that's what the Beijing has saw so far, not heavy. And also, from Beijing's perspective, yeah, I read a lot of Chinese publications after that. They saw her as a soft, independent promoter. It's a softer, 软性台独. That's what the Chinese said. She would not talk as tough as Chen Shui-bian and those legal 法理台独 people would talk about. But in her heart, that's what people in Beijing said, she would want to have independence. And she would do whatever she could. Of course, she has been constrained. But if give her the room, she would do whatever she could to push forward the independence cause, such as in the Chinese publications, they talk about those culturally try to be de-Chinese-ness, 去中国化. And diplomacy, they tried also to promote the more space for Taiwan. And in Ma Ying-jeou's time, the Taiwan's diplomacy went to the world through China, through Beijing. Now they go to Washington or go to Tokyo instead of Beijing. So they thought Tsai Ing-wen would make a lot of these kind of changes. So that's how they set up very clear so-called red line. The deadline, red line is to speak the Beijing's words of 1992 consensus, which she could not say. But that was the political foundation. They said, we'll have exchanges. We'll continue our peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. And setting that deadline, China has been had, before the inauguration, sent out a lot of warnings about consequences if you don't say that words, economic, diplomatic, isolation, many things. Among them, for me, I paid attention to several words they talked about. They said the relationship will come to a stalemate. 僵持阶段. Stalemate would like a cold confrontation, then 对抗, that's a learned term. They talked about, even they talk about the sanctions will be ready. 如见在贤, 惩罚措施如见在贤. So all these terms they talked about, even they talked 地动山摇, the mountain will be shaking. That's what they want before the inauguration of 2000, the May 20th. Then what happened? Of course, we did not see 地动山摇, earthquake did not come. However, China took a lot of actions, tried to warn, tried to bring Tsai Ing-wen back to the track they would want to see. I don't think they have accomplished that. They know they have not accomplished that either. So in that context, after May 20th, I think the patience in Beijing has been the short of supply of the commodity. Among the Chinese scholars I talked to and among the Chinese officials, read their publications, I'm seeing they're losing patience or become increasingly impatient in the last several months. Why they become so impatient? Because they now realize that Tsai Ing-wen is not going to speak their term. In fact, the Washington Post interview, you read Chinese comments on that, that become, the for them, the last final words. Tsai Ing-wen said, will not take 1992 consensus, for sure. Another thing here from mainland China perspective, they have facing a paradox in those years, because for many years, China thought China's economic integration with Taiwan and also China becoming more and more strong gave them confidence to bring Taiwan closer. But in fact, now you read Chinese publications, they said, we have not accomplished that. Taiwan has been leaving China further away while we become stronger. In those polls in Taiwan, they have found Chinese identity in Taiwan has been declining while Taiwan identity has been rising. That's a very big concern for them. All those Yindan Gongshi silver cannon offenses have not been successful. They are talking about if we wait longer, that trend will continue. Why? Because of young generation's 天然台独, natural tendency toward independence. That's a big concern to Chinese leaders, especially talk about Taiwan's leaders. Now, in Tsai Ing-wen administration, we push forward 去中国化, de-China education, and some cultural activities that will further push the young generation less identify with the mainland China. So, in that context, what I read in last several months, at least one last couple months, has been that 和平统一已经没有希望了. We have to abandon the illusion of a peaceful unification. 晚打不如早打. To fight a war, better to find war early than later. That's what the people talk about. You'll be surprised to read that. Zhu Chenghu and talked as soldier. We have to make sure we are ready to fight a war to win. Of course, we not trust Zhu Chenghu.
May not be a fight.
But at least they agitate those nationalist views. Jin Chanrong, you read Jin Chanrong's, even more strange, he talked about four stages taught Tsai Ing-wen to observe, then to punish, then to conflict, then to wage a war. The four stages, wow. He talked everywhere in China. You saw those on the internet, website, the WeChat, all those places. So popular, those views. Then you look back to the Chinese leadership talking on these issues. Deng Xiaoping, let me step back a little bit. During Chen Shui-bian administration, 8 years, China, what they did was to prevent independence, 防毒. Then during Ma Ying-jeou's 8 years, what they did was to promote unification. Now, when Tsai Ing-wen came to office, I think what they tried to do is set timetable for the eventual unification. Deng Xiaoping said we can wait 1,000 years. And Jiang Zemin tried to set timetable, but never had ability to do that, so did not do much. Now Xi Jinping, I think he's talking about that very seriously. He, in 2013, he talked about the political disagreement across Taiwan Strait have to be resolved, cannot be passed on generation to generation. Then July 1st, the 79th birthday of the Communist Party, he's talked about, he linked the, he said, Taiwan 统一是, Taiwan 问题是祖国统一大业没有完成的部分, the only incomplete part of the mission. And also he linked Taiwan issue to his China dream. China dream has two stages, we all know that. One stage is 2021, the 100 years anniversary of the founding of PRC. The second stage is 49, 100 years of the founding of PRC. When the founding of the CCP, one founding of the PRC. So there are two stages. So reading those kind of comments, you can see if we cannot resolve that, Jin Chanrong talk 2021, that's the first stage. So if we cannot resolve this in the first stage, we will get that done in the second stage. If we read that way implications, it's that times table, which is implicit, but it's clear to many readers. Why Xi Jinping became so confident? Because you see China's activities in South China Sea, in East China Sea, China reverse of the Taoguang Yanghui to proactive policy. In the past, they had dilemma working with Taiwan to have a peaceful versus military threat. Using peaceful means, they were afraid of Taiwan independence. Using military threat, they were afraid of damage to the economic modernization. That dilemma no longer there. All those big picture has been so clear that Chinese leaders become more confident to resolve the so-called Taiwan issue on its own term, not with the help of the United States or anyone else, with its own term. So that's very dangerous. Which, in that case, to end these remarks, I will say U.S. is doing well. Taiwan is doing well. The only variable is Beijing, which we still want Beijing to be patient. Otherwise, we'll see a lot of other side of consequences. Thank you.
I hope Beijing is patient. I also hope that they base their judgments on knowledge, wisdom, and good judgment. And remember that what we're talking about ultimately is 23 million people who have their own views. Right? So we have 21 minutes. Thanks to the panel for staying on time. I'm sure there are some good questions waiting out there, so I'm not going to say a single thing more. Who would like to ask the first question? Yang Dali, up here.
We have on Taiwan a president who is female. And of course, we also have all those stereotypes about leadership and, you know, Asian cultures and so on. How does the gender issue plays into cross-strait relations?
Okay. We have two gentlemen from Taiwan who... well, you're... Any gentlemen want to answer that question?
I think, Tsai Ing-wen is the first female president in Taiwan's history. But I don't think we should focus on the gender issue, because this question goes for a question that is about Taiwan's democratic system. No matter you are male or female, you have to follow the people's will according to the democratic system in Taiwan. So that's one thing I would like to emphasize. And the other thing I want to touch upon is that compared to other Asian countries, Tsai Ing-wen probably is the first one to win the presidency without any kind of, you know, political family behind. So mm-hmm. that is a very unique example we can find out in Asia's history to offer for your reference. Thank you.
Anybody else? I mean, my answer would be that I think generation is more important than gender here, and that Tsai Ing-wen
has an appeal to both young men and young women.
Were all men. On the other side of the street are seven men sitting on the Politburo Standing Committee, though.
It's a problem. It's a big problem. I'm afraid I can't give you my evidence, but it's a problem. Sujin, right here.
Thank you. From this morning until now, we have heard this term comes up again, desinicization in Taiwan, in Taiwan's policy. I don't understand that at all. I don't see anything in her policy has having any effect of desinicification. Actually, in Taiwan, her mainland China policy has been severely criticized as being too blue. Okay, so I'm really appalled by the divergent perception across the strait on Taiwan's mainland China policy. So I would be delighted to be enlightened by any gentlemen or ladies. Thank you.
Anybody want to speak to that?
Indeed, I see Tsai Ing-wen more like Ma Ying-jeou. Indeed, because Ma Ying-jeou, when he was supposed to be KMT president, he tried to not work with his fundamental supporters, try to be a president of the all Taiwan people, which is right. But the first term, yes. The Tsai Ing-wen and this at stage is pretty much like Tsai Ing-jeou, illusion to be able to be a president of everyone in Taiwan, which is not possible. So in that case, her mainland China policy has not been very clear and help her that much.
Bonnie?
Obviously, the Chinese have drawn conclusions about Tsai Ing-wen, you know, long before she even really announced for her candidacy. And then experts in China then look for evidence to prove that. So when Chen Shui-bian was president, this was a big concern. So I think that this has almost been sort of like transferred onto her shoulders, and it's based on fear. And one of the first things that they, of course, pointed to was the reversal of the decision about the change in the textbooks. And that was really highlighted in China as an example of this de-sinification.
Textbooks.
The textbooks in Taiwan. So Ma Ying-jeou had, as you know, tried to make them sort of more once again about Chinese history, not just Taiwan. My understanding is there's been a decision to reverse that. And so this is not a decision made by the president, but yet, of course, they assign that blame to her. But I do think it is in large part based on fear.
I agree with that. And I think that I would add that there are three realities going on here that I think Beijing really doesn't understand or wish to admit. Number one, you know, let's ask ourselves, which side of the strait has done a better job in preserving traditional Chinese culture? Number two, do you establish your identity from textbooks or from life experience? Number three, is it not possible that Taiwan people have multiple identities, Chinese, Taiwanese, and cosmopolitan, all at the same time? And so it's not one or the other. It's my editorial. Another question. Let's go to the back. We've had people. So the lady right there in the white skirt. Up here. Up this way. Right there. We'll go further
thank
back.
You. Rita Chen from the Central News Agency, Taiwan. My question is for Richard and Boni. I'm focusing about the U.S. transition because the time is coming. But do you see that any possibility that China maybe operate some action to stimulate or escalate the tension on Taiwan Strait during the U.S. transition time? How will you suggest the U.S. administration to avoid that situation? China try to challenge U.S. maybe.
So I think in the final months of the Obama administration and the early months of a new administration, there is a possibility where China would seek to advance its own interests on a number of issues. And there is a history of China testing new presidents, so that's something that we should certainly be mindful of. My own feeling is, however, that it's not likely to be aimed at Taiwan. There's already a tendency, as I think Zhao Shuisheng talked about, to sort of turn the screws, increase pressure. We obviously see more in the economic side. We're going to see more in the diplomatic side. I doubt we will see anything on the military side unless there's anything they deem really, really provocative. But I just don't think that it's likely that they're going to do anything in this period that would give the United States a reason to rethink its policy towards Taiwan. Ultimately, China wants to have a smooth transition. They wanted this when Obama was elected, regardless of who was president in the United States. They want to keep this relationship on a fairly even keel, on a sound footing. And that's the message that we're hearing, of course, from many people in China as we go into this transition. They're concerned about possible shifts and especially unpredictability about one of the candidates. And perhaps either of them or both of them, whichever is elected, having a somewhat tougher policy toward China. If they were to undertake some truly confrontational measure toward Taiwan, then that would probably result in some rethink in a new administration and cause a new president to be tougher. My sense is we're likely to see testing on other issues.
I would only add, and I agree with all of that, is that when you have a presidential campaign that is well-organized and professional, and one of the campaigns this time is well-organized and professional, you think well in advance of the challenges you will face from the day of the election on, from everywhere, domestic, international. And so I would be surprised if there aren't some people who have already thought of your question and thought of what the responses would be. Certainly hope so. There's a question way in the back. Was there a question way in the back? Yeah, there was. Okay.
Thank you. I didn't realize I was way in the back. Harry Harding.
From
again.
My perspective, you're miles
I'm
away.
Way, yeah. Harry Harding again. We've had a very, very good discussion of what might be called the most likely scenarios, and they have positives and negatives in them. At the risk of ending things on a down note, I want to ask about two perhaps worst-case scenarios. One has already been identified by Sam Zhao, and that is that China will lose patience and increase the pressure on both the United States and Taiwan. And I guess, Sam, is what can we tell Beijing persuasively that will encourage them to remain patient? What are the trends that are moving towards peaceful unification as opposed to all the trends that are leading away from it? We can say be patient, but unless we can give them some plausible scenario for this to work out in the way that they want, I'm not sure that advice is going to be well received. The other worst-case scenario, which no one has talked about, is that the United States decides to put it bluntly, abandon Taiwan. There are two schools of thought that lead to that conclusion in the U.S. One is that we do it deliberately as part of some kind of bargain with China, either a grand bargain or a series of smaller bargains, where we get something in return and feel this is a reasonable price to pay. The other would be the one put forward by John Mearsheimer in his article provocatively entitled Say Goodbye to Taiwan, is that the United States may not want to abandon Taiwan, is not going to get anything positive out of it, but will simply feel from a realist perspective there is no choice. It is too high a price. And so I wonder if you could comment on both of those worst-case scenarios. Beijing loses patience, the United States abandons Taiwan.
I don't see any way except one word or one way to tell Beijing to be patient. That is domestic problem in China. Chinese economy may derail and China rise would derail too. So Chinese leaders have more worried domestically than the Taiwan issue. Even on that front, I'm also a little bit suspicious because if that happens, Chinese leaders might use Taiwan issue to divert domestic crisis. So in that context, Chinese leaders now become so confident that they can deal with almost all the international issues in their own ways and own timetable and own terms. In fact, the Red Chinese publication, one thing I think, they said Taiwan issue is resolved by the three factors. One is the interests. No, I put that down. Three factors. One is power, one is 实力, the strength. Second is interest. Third is people's mind. So among the three factors, the 实力, the strength is most important factor. Then the interest, which is related to the strength, will determine the direction of the relationship and also determine the third factor, that's people's mind. If we have the power, you will have the interest attract you, then you have come to our side. So in that mindset, real Mearsheimer type of thinking, power politics and real politics, interest politics, they would not want to listen to anyone's advice that be patient. They will be patient only when they decide from their own perspective, we cannot do it. If we can do it, they will do it.
Bonnie, and then Wen Cheng.
Important questions, Harry, and I'll start with the abandonment of Taiwan, which my very close friend Nancy Tucker and I wrote about years ago. I think that the prospects or the possibility of the U.S. abandoning Taiwan are less today than they were when we wrote that article. Against the background of the rebalance to Asia, the challenges that are faced with the management of China's rise and trying to shape China's choices, I think it would be fundamentally against U.S. interests to abandon Taiwan. I just don't see any scenario in which the U.S. engages in a negotiation with Beijing about somehow abandoning its commitments to Taiwan. I think your question on China losing patience, my answer would be that despite all of the trends in Taiwan in terms of the attitudes of the people who overwhelmingly do not favor unification, nevertheless, I don't see a formal independence being an option for Taiwan. And so even if China has diminished hope in reunification in the near future, it seems to me that the preservation of the status quo is still the most likely scenario, that Taiwan is not likely to be able to use any leverage to, for example, you know, re-enter the United Nations as a separate country. China's own capabilities, even with the slowdown of its economy, I think is still likely to be fairly great in the international community. So I would tell the Chinese that there is still a basis for retaining patience. When they get their own act in order, when China has a better economy and an open political system, maybe someday people of Taiwan would like to have a different relationship with China. And so there's no need for them to be so urgent in the near term.
One Chung and then Ming Yan, and then we'll
come to a question. Yeah, I would like to comment on Shem's quite a scary remarks, you know. Beijing is going to lose patience, and that Beijing is setting a timetable. You know, Mao Zedong once said to Kissinger that Taiwan is not an important issue. China can wait for, you know, 100 years or 300 years. Today, to me, you know, Taiwan is still not an important issue to Xi Jinping in his political agenda. You know, Xi Jinping is preoccupied with so many domestic challenges, you know. So if Xi Jinping is losing the patience on the Taiwan issue and would like to, you know, unify Taiwan, you know, in his term, then it means that he loses confidence that he can carry out, you know, domestic reforms, you know, because he wants to, you know, have the, you know, the legacy on the Taiwan issue. To do something that Mao Zedong could not, you know, complete, and also, you know, Deng Xiaoping and you know, Jiang Zemin or Hu Jintao, means that he already lose the confidence to complete what he wanted to do domestically. Then, you know, he want to leave the legacy on the Taiwan issue. That's, you know, what President Ma tried to do. In 8 years, he failed in all of the other sectors of the policies, and he would like to leave, you know, his legacy on the cross-trade relations. I hope it's not, you know. So I still believe that you know, Taiwan is not one of the top priority issue in this political agenda. I went to mainland China last month. I visited China so often. Chinese friend continue to tell me. The Taiwan issue is not an important issue in Xi Jinping's agenda. Okay, that's my comments. Seems quite a scary remark. Okay, then, you know, here is the questions. You know, I mentioned in my presentation that we in Taiwan were quite concerned whether we might be sold out by United States again or not. You know, because you know. We political scientists are trained that it is a world of the real politics, you know. So every country concerned with its you know, national interest. Of course, we cannot blame you know, United States if one day United States decide to you know sacrifice Taiwan again. But the question is, what can United States get from the from China by you know reaching a deal with China, you know? From 2004 to 2008, Taiwan was described by China as a troublemaker. It means that we made troubles, you know, in the relations between the United States and China. But in the 8 years, you know, under President Ma's leadership, we are a good boy. We did not make any trouble, you know. And then, of course, you know, the conflict, you know, between the United States and China increased. So even today, you sacrifice Taiwan, it does not mean the conflict between the two countries will be gone. It continues, you know. Because you know, that's China's perceptions that United States tried to contain China, that kind of stories you can heard you know, again and again in China. So by sacrificing Taiwan, what can United States get? Nothing. Thank you.
Okay. Ming Yan, you have the last word.
Okay, thank you. I think when we talk about the point that China is now losing its patience on Taiwan issues, there is a broader picture behind. That is, China is now losing patience toward everything. China is losing its patience toward U.S. policy on South China Sea, losing patience on Japan's efforts to become a normal state, and losing patience to South Korea's decision to deploy U.S. THAAD system. So I think the problem is that when China was weak, China was always patient. But when China is becoming stronger, China wants to show its determination to protect this country's core interest. So I think that's the magic logic behind China is losing its patience. So I think the problem is not from the Taiwan side. It's from the Chinese side. China needs to position itself properly in this region and around the world. Otherwise, we would see an impatient China everywhere.
Okay. Well, even if China is losing patience, you all didn't lose patience. And you stayed through the whole program, and we thank you very much for that. I started by expressing gratitude. I'm going to end by expressing gratitude, first of all, to our panelists. Second to all the people, including Chris Johnson, who flew all the way across the Pacific to get here for this conference. To Chris and all our other friends at CISIS for the terrific collaboration we've had over a number of years concerning Taiwan. To Scott for doing the luncheon keynote. And particularly to IIR for its outstanding work in making this conference possible. And Arthur, personal thanks to you as well. So we've learned a lot today. We may not have all the answers, but at least we know most of the questions. So thank you very much.